Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
We picked making yogurt because it was, to me, it was easy. I was being lazy about it. I'm like, there's only one ingredient, milk. Like, how hard can this
right.
be? And like, I was single and I was like, I'm going to go and like flirt with boys at the farmer's market. Like that was my goal.
This week, it is my distinct pleasure to welcome Homa Dashtaki, the founder of the best commercially available yogurt on the planet. At the very least, the best one I've ever tasted, White Mustache Yogurt. I have personally contributed thousands of dollars to your 401k, Homa. I just want you to know that.
I thank you.
I have one of your yogurts every day for breakfast. So welcome to Special Sauce. It's so nice to have you here.
That's very generous. Thank you.
So many interesting chapters in the story of your life. So let's jump right in. You know, first, tell us about life at the Dashtaki family growing up. I want all the not so gory details, like where, what, when, and why.
Well, I mean, to me, it seems quite boring, but we are immigrants, my family and I. I was born in Iran. I was born the day of the Iranian Revolution. So the day the Ayatollah arrived to Iran, I was born. And my mom had to go to the hospital in like a police escort because there was a curfew. And like, you know, it's all probably why I'm like so wired to like chaos all around me.
So that's probably the most dramatic entrance I've ever heard.
Right. And now I'm just used to fanfare no matter what I do. I'm like, where's my parade? But yeah, so we were like, you know, and that was like my childhood until I was 8. We were in the middle of the revolution. Then there was the Iran-Iraq war where like missile sirens at night and everything was like normal, and like you had birthday parties that you still went to, and there were weddings you still went to, and like life still went on. And like, you know, it wasn't until I was an adult here that I like would recount this story and be like, oh, that was probably a little weird or strange or out of the ordinary. And then we had an uncle who had come to America about 16 years before I was born, and he had been able to get green cards for all of his brothers. So we came in through kind of like that wait list. And
the stuff that Trump wouldn't allow these days.
I mean, he probably wouldn't be into it. But we got in and, you know, settled in Orange County, California, where I went to school. And we went there because there was a large Zoroastrian population there.
How would you describe a Zoroastrian? Is it an ethnic group within Iran?
A little bit, but it's a religion.
Got it.
So, I mean, I kind of think of it the same way maybe in America it's analogous to the Native Americans. Zoroastrianism was the first monotheistic religion of the Persian Empire, and then it dwindled down into what is modern-day Iran. And my family comes from a town called Yazd, which is in, like, southern Iran in the middle, in the desert region. And, yeah.
Before you left for the States, what was life like at your family table?
I mean, I remember growing up and hating bell peppers because my mom would always make this one rice dish with tomatoes and lima beans and bell peppers and ground meat in it. And I would have to sit there until it was finished. And there was always a rice dish on the table. And there was always something called khoresht, which is like a stew that you put on top of the rice. And there was always pickles, like a garlic pickle or a cauliflower pickle. And there's always yogurt.
And there was always yogurt.
There's always yogurt.
There's where yogurt makes its entrance into your life.
Right. I mean, it's always been there, and it's like a way that you rescue a meal. So if your rice is a little like soggy, or if it's a little dry, like the yogurt saves it. If like your stew isn't flavored as much, your yogurt saves it.
And this was yogurt that they made.
Yeah, we made yogurt at home all the time. And it's like not because we were being gourmet foodies. And like even in the States when we came here, I thought everyone made yogurt at home too. And I just thought this is what we do. And, you know, growing up, when I would see like a Yoplait on the shelves at the store, I would always ask my mom, like, why can't we have that? You know, because that seemed like special yogurt to me. And so it's just like a different in perspective.
And did you always love it?
Yogurt? Yeah. Like, I always loved rice and tea and, you know, other things that were just always there. It was just such a comfort. Like, rice and yogurt is an Iranian kind of comfort food. Like, it comforts an upset stomach, and it's like something you eat if you're, you know, even if it sounds boring, but if you're bored of cooking, it's like the perfect meal, and like crack a few, like, you know, peppers on top, and that's like just goes down perfectly. And then potato chips and yogurt is a typical Iranian snack food.
Wow. And you eat it. How can we never see that here?
I've had trouble getting savory yogurt to people. Like, the thought of like yogurt and sour translates to spoiled.
You made a shallot yogurt for a while, right?
Yeah, I still do. It's just hard to reconcile white mustaches, sour cherries and dates and quince with like shallot. And I have the most responses I've gotten about the shallot yogurt through emails that we get feedback is like complaints. Like, I picked up this yogurt and it didn't go well with my granola. And I'm like, well,
that's awesome.
Yeah, I'm like, okay, I'm sorry about that. That's my fault. I should have put that disclaimer on.
Do not combine with granola. Mm-hmm. So your family moved to Southern California in 87.
Yep.
Into a town with a large Zoroastrian community.
Correct.
And what was that like? Was it hard to move to the States? Like, did you miss your friends? Did you miss Iran?
I was too young to really figure it out in that sense and to say I missed Iran or something. I had such a connection with the Zoroastrian community in Orange County that it felt like that was like my safe place where people were just like me and had weird names and ate weird food. But like, to us, that was all normal. And then we would go to school and like our neighbors and every place else was like another community that I had access to and had to figure out how to fit in. And I think the hardest part for me would be going back to Iran and being like, okay, I don't fit in here either anymore because now I'm American. But then being in America and be like, well, I don't fit in here either because everyone thinks I'm Iranian. And
you know, a lot of people that have been on Special Sauce talk about that dual discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
Ed Lee talks about that, the Korean-American chef in D.C. And it's such an interesting thing because it's usually people say, oh, I love going back to my homeland. And then you realize it's an odd thing to go back and forth.
Right. It's this like uncanny familiarity that you're still foreign to because you're visiting when you go back home. But then when you're here in America, which is home, like I didn't feel truly American or that I can identify with America as American or that America gave me permission to identify as American until I went to London and I studied abroad. And when I was here, I would tell everyone I'm Iranian because that's like what the script was. And when I went to London, I'd be like, I'm Iranian. And all of my like British peers and like friends would be like, no, you're not. Like, listen to your accent. Listen to the things you talk about. Like, look at the kind of cheese you eat. You're American.
That's so interesting.
And I was like, of course. And it just took that. It took the other kind of like this other to validate that identity for me at like the age of, you know, 19. And that was pretty incredible.
Yeah, that's interesting because, and at home, did you speak English or Farsi?
Farsi. We spoke Farsi and we spoke a dialect of Farsi that the Zoroastrians speak, which is Dari. And I mean, on top of all of this, like I'm feeling guilty because the Zoroastrian community is only 100,000 practicing people left in the world between Iran, India, the U.S. and London. And you feel this like weight of your culture, like if I don't keep up these traditions, they're going to die off. And, you know, you're part of the progress. Like we now live in America. Like I don't live and breathe the Zoroastrian culture the way I would if I was still living in Iran surrounded by only that community. So, like, I've had to translate that level of guilt somehow. I mean, white mustache for, like, you know, maybe from what it seems like from the outside. But to me, it's almost like the explosion of all of this identity crisis and like, where does it have a home? And it's like in this little product that comes out is like, it's the result of my catharsis.
Well, you know, you told Nikita Richardson at Fast Company, you said, I don't know what it is about this yoga, but it's the first authentic thing I've ever done. It's like bringing in this other part of my identity that I never really gave a lot of credit to. I didn't know how to celebrate being different.
Yeah. Well, first of all, Nikita is very disarming. So that is, that woman is amazing.
You
that
ain't
she got
seen
that out of
nothing
me.
Yet
I
when
know.
It comes to disarming.
I mean, I'm already like, whatever. but yeah, I almost didn't know it, but it is the most authentic thing I've ever created. And it's like got a big white mustache on it, which represents my father. It's in like a glass jar, which represents like, you know, how I feel about like the environment and also like the amount of work that goes into the yogurt is me holding on to like our tradition and the art of making yogurt, which, by the way, like my whole family like laughs at. They're like, what? You're making yogurt and selling it? It's like the oldest thing. It's the simplest thing. Like, why aren't you doing more complicated things like making granola or making like something more Western or special? And it's like, it's too simple.
Yeah.
You've
literally gone native on them.
Yes. Right. And I think like something that's come out of this that's very special is like I've kind of inspired, I guess, the young people in our community to value these things instead of running away from them and being like, well, maybe I can add value through these things in the outside. I'm like, maybe what we have from within is what's valuable.
Yeah.
Something as simple as yogurt that's always been in front of us that I actually made without even thinking about it.
Yeah, and that's so interesting. Yeah. Are the Zoroastrians persecuted now in Iran, the ones that are left? I can't imagine they're made to feel comfortable.
Right. And it's just because they're in a religious government. So it's like an Islamic republic where, you know, like in schools, you're taught the Quran, where we're not taught that. And, you know, there's really no motivation to learn it except to like grow within the academic system. And so there is just a huge, I guess, formal distinction between Zoroastrians and the rest of the community. But like a lot of, you know, our friends are Muslim. And like when you go there, I just feel like the Iranian people as a culture are so hospitable and so generous in spirit and warm. Like our last trip there, we never stayed at a hotel. You literally just drive through the countryside and we're like, can we stay at your house?
Stranger and people person, you don't know.
People I don't know. And they let you stay in like their spare bedroom. You give them some cash. And you're like, can you make us that dish that you're cooking for your family for us too? And it's been like, so, and I learned that from my dad because like when he was doing it, I'm like, Daddy, is this legal? Like, you know, and I'm like, are we allowed to do this? And it was actually very, very special.
Yeah, it was a de facto Iranian Airbnb.
Right, exactly.
I mean, just in case you, if you wanted to start a business, I'll be partners with you. So you ended up at UCLA, and then you went to law school.
Yeah.
And you also told Nikita, I wanted to be a lawyer since I was very young because I thought the idea of writing contracts and having everyone's expectations down on paper was so civilized.
Oh, I love the whole idea of it. Like, you would tell me what you wanted. You'd put it down on paper. Everything would be clear. And I remember, like, when I first found out about, like, prenups, I remember everyone was like very negative about them. I'm like, how wonderful. Like when you're getting into this really like intense relationship that everyone would just be above board and like you either know how like great it's going to be or how fucked you're going to be. Like it's all like laid out.
That's awesome.
So but I love and I came from so much chaos too that like it was just like, okay, and it could be a private situation where it's not like the government imposing like this civility, like two individuals are being very clear about what they want, putting it down on paper. And I love that. So,
but then, so you went to work for a corporate law firm, you know, like a very fancy one as far as I can tell. Mm-hmm. And then you got laid off. I don't think you fell in love with practicing law because from what I've read, you wandered for a while after that. Mm-hmm. Like, what'd you do? Like, you didn't just start sending your resume out to other law firms.
No, it's funny you say that because I became a lawyer because I checked off all the boxes. Like, as a good girl, I, like, went to school, went to law school, got a good job, and I, like, got to wear fancy clothes and, like, work on fancy deals and really, like, you know, be full of myself for a while. And then once I got laid off, I remember I had, like, one of our clients was like, oh, we'd like for you to come work in-house. And I went and I interviewed for that job, and I so did not want that job. Like, they would ask me questions that I should have known, and I answered it as if I had, like, not been working in, like, the finance industry forever. It's like I'd been working at, like, Dairy Queen for the last, like, 5 years or something. I just did not want to go back to it, and I just wandered. And
I had the same experience. I worked at a big ad agency after business school and then got laid off mercifully because they tried to tell me how to walk and all this stuff. And then I had a job interview as like a product manager at Colgate Palmolive. And they started asking me all these questions. And I was like, I'm not answering these questions in any way that they're going to find acceptable because I don't want this job.
Right.
I would hate myself if I went there every day. So you had that same experience.
Yeah. And it's very visceral. It's not like I thought about it or it was like conscious. It was like, I can't, like, I just am not going to.
So what did you end up doing?
I got bored. I got really, really bored. I went to an avocado farm and I thought I would like pitch in at the avocado farm. And
that's good. Traditional linear career path.
Absolutely. I left the East Coast, went to an avocado farm in San Diego. And it turns out it wasn't even avocado season. So there I am, like, unemployed, a little depressed. I think I'd just broken up with, like, somebody. And I was, like, chain smoking in this, like, beautiful avocado farm for 3 months. And it was, like, really depressing. And then after that, as one does, I, like, and like, very type A, you know, throw myself into something intensely. I took up yoga and I just started doing yoga religiously for like a year and a half. And I will say that probably has been like one of the biggest skill sets I've put to use to this date, like meditating and doing crazy yoga. And then I started teaching yoga, which I was like really bad at because I would just like yell at people. Come on,
know.
You're not even trying. And so
that's really not my idea of what I would regard as an ideal yoga teacher.
Sometimes people need a good kick in the pants, and that was my role. But yeah, nobody was really coming to yoga class for that. Like,
yeah.
No one's ready for the tough love yoga teacher part yet.
So when you came back, you talk about your dad fell into a funk. What happened to him, and how did you two sort of figure out that what you wanted to do was make yogurt?
Well, that latter part was a total accident, figuring out how to make yogurt. What had happened was, like, my dad's brother had committed suicide.
Wow.
And, I mean, I don't want to say in Iranian culture, but it's just a hard thing to talk about. And we're not very big on mental health in our community or talking about it. And there's like a shame that comes with like somebody mm-hmm. in the family having committed suicide that you don't talk about. And this is the uncle who I mentioned like 16 years before I was born had gotten, like, he was responsible for bringing
wow.
us all to America.
So he was like the paternal figure in the family as
yeah.
a whole.
Yeah. And he was awesome. Like, he was so charismatic, even though he was Zoroastrian, he was in North Carolina. He was very active in the Baptist church there in North Carolina because he just wanted community. He's like,
you gotta find your community where you can find it in North Carolina.
Yeah.
It's the Baptist church.
Yeah, he's like, these are my people. And we're like, cool. And he was amazing. And then to find out that he passed in that way was such a cloud of mystery. And my dad just like wasn't processing it very well. And like, we've always been close, my dad and I, and I was unemployed at that time and he was going through this. And I was like, we got to do something. And it was just a hobby. And like, we picked making yogurt because it was just something he would do all the time anyway. And to me, it was easy. And I was kind of, you know, I was being lazy about it. I'm like, there's only one ingredient, milk. Like, how hard can this
right.
be?
Right. I got this.
I got this. And, like, I, you know, I was single and I was like, I'm going to go and, like, flirt with boys at the farmer's market. Like, that was my goal.
That was my goal. It's interesting you talk about with you and your dad that yogurt was something to help you both get through, right? You talked about you didn't want to start a business. You needed therapy.
Therapy. Yeah. It was something physical, like that physically creating something. And honestly, not having to think about it, it was just so easy and so repetitive. And so, I don't know if you've ever made yogurt at home, but it's a very magical process. It's almost like you step into like a time portal and you have to slow down time. Like in order for your yogurt to take, it has to be coddled. Like you have to boil the milk and you have to get it to the right temperature. Like that's actually no easy task. You have to pay attention to the milk. You can't just like set it and forget it. And we're not making this in a machine. We're actually just using fire. And that's it. Like, you know, if I could teach anyone how to make yogurt, I'd want to teach you how to make it if all you had was like, you know, like a gallon of milk and that's it. And so that's how we were making yogurt because that's how he had always made it. And I didn't want to reinvent the wheel with anything.
So did you develop your yogurt culture just through stirring, just through the preparation?
Yeah, and you would just use the culture from the previous batch. So whatever batch we had in our fridge from the last time, we would use it. And, you know, at the beginning, we were using cultures from like, there's a brand of yogurt in California called Mountain High that we got at the local Iranian stores and like just use that and make one. And then whatever we would make from that would be in the fridge and we would make the other batches from that.
And then you started making the yogurt in an Egyptian restaurant.
Oh, yeah. So California, like, you know how you find, like, miraculous restaurants and strip malls? Like, all of a sudden, there's this, like, gourmet sushi place in this, like, weird strip mall that's totally unassuming. So there was this Egyptian restaurant in a strip mall right near my parents' house that was so, they just made, like, they made their own hummus from scratch. And I walked in and I was like, I would like to use your kitchen to, like, make yogurt because we wanted to sell at farmers markets and there was like a permit or something and you needed
because you needed to meet the guys at the farmers market.
Right, exactly. I'm like, I need to go flirt, so we need to use your kitchen at night to make yogurt. And he was great. He let us come in at night around like 9 o'clock when he shut down and let us work through the night. And then when he came in at 11, we'd be all wrapped up and finished and like take our stuff with us and like leave some yogurt in the fridge. And the name of the restaurant is Karistina's, and it was incredible. Like I felt like Christmas elves or something. We just scurry in and make it and then leave. And then, you know, we were only making 8 gallons of yogurt a week.
Wow.
So you know,
so how did it go at the farmers market, both selling the yogurt and meeting guys?
Yeah, so the first farmers market we went to was in Huntington Beach, California. It was raining. We're right on the beach and we made $12.
Don't spend it all in one place.
No, definitely not. But like that was the moment, and I always joke about this, that like that's when I knew we made it. Like I'm like, this is the thing. Like we made, I'm like, it cost like $80 for the booth or something. And I was like, all my education, like my light bulb goes off. I'm like, yep, this is a winner. And it was mainly like, I think we sold what we were selling them. We were selling them at like $4 a jar then. So we sold 3 jars. And it was people's reactions to the yogurt. They were tasting yogurt for the first time.
I felt that way when I tasted your yogurt.
That's
man.
Amazing.
No, it's true. I don't make that stuff up.
And like imagine, like to me, this was like the simplest thing that we were doing at home. And as a child, I was begging my mom for Yoplait, you know, because I thought that was like the fancy American thing to do. And so when I saw people's reactions, it felt very special and moving. And that I was like sharing a part of us or my culture that I would normally either try to hide or even try to like paint over or somehow make glossier. And this was just pure raw Iranian yogurt. Like all the flavors we had, like we didn't put out blueberry or chocolate or strawberry. We would put out like sour cherry did not come into existence till we came to New York.
Wow.
I was doing the orange blossom honey and walnuts in LA and the mint walnut raisin.
Which you're not doing anymore.
We do that like for 2 weeks in the wintertime.
All right,
around the winter solstice.
You gotta let me know when that happens. But then you started making more yogurt, selling more yogurt. And things seemed like things were, from what I read, were going pretty well. And then you get this phone call that sort of throws the whole thing into reverse.
Yeah.
What happened?
Yeah, so we started at the Huntington Beach Farmers Market. We went from the Huntington Beach Farmers Market. We added the Irvine Farmers Market. Then we were looking at the Fullerton Farmers Market. And then we get into Laguna Beach Farmers Market, which, like in the farmers market world, you've really made it. And I don't know. Like, my sister's very convinced that the olive lady called us into the State Department, or somebody did.
The State Health Department or whatever.
It was the dairy regulation.
Got it.
So we had had all of our city and county and local permits to do it. That's why we were working at the commercial kitchen. And again, like, we're just there to flirt with boys and sell some yogurt. And, you know, we know we were onto something, but at no point was I like, I'm sinking my life into this and making it a business. And then it was like 2 hours into the Laguna Beach Farmers Market. We'd almost sold everything that we had brought. So we were like, this is amazing. And then it was only my sister and I who went to that market. By this point, my dad had been like kicked out of the business because he just argued with me too much.
That's one way to calm down a family business.
Right.
Just throw the father out.
Just throw the father out. And, like, I've been kicked out plenty of times, too. It's just, you know, sometimes I bully my way back in. And so we get the call from this woman named Scarlett Treviso, who runs the California Food and Drug Administration for that region. And she calls me on a Saturday morning on my cell phone, which I have no idea how she got, saying that if I don't shut down the booth, they're going to fine me $10,000 and send me to prison for a year. And at this—
Like, she wasn't kidding?
I thought she was kidding. I thought it was, like, a law school buddy of mine who found out I was making yogurt and, like, wanted to, like, take the piss and, like, make fun of me. And, like, I was like, oh, ha, ha, this is a really good one. And she was like, no, I'm serious. And I was like, you can't be serious. Like, I'm making it in a, like, I can show you all of our permits. And I'm making 8 gallons of milk a week. And you're probably thinking of, like, someone who's using raw milk or one of these other things that California cracks down on so much. But I was buying my milk from the grocery store. Like, I was like,
right, can't be a more commercial product.
It just really couldn't have been more. Like, I'm buying the milk that I buy, like, at Vaughn's or, like, well, we were getting it at Breguire's Dairy, which is, like, a very fancy California dairy. And in, like, glass bottles that I was paying for at retail. And I was like, there's no way that, like, I'm doing what you think I'm doing. Like,
wow.
I'll come and show it. And she's like, no, you need to shut down right now or I'll be there in an hour. And I was like, okay, this is ridiculous. And I remember she said something on that call that, like, really, like, just, like, was has been a splinter in my soul since she said it. And it was like, she had said that just a few months ago, she had shut down a Mexican family who was doing the same and a Vietnamese family that was making a milkshake. And I was like, you sound like a racist, dude. Like, it's just like, what, like, these people are probably making good food. And they're probably small families like mine, but they're probably small families like mine who don't have a law degree and don't have, like, the kind of privilege and education I have. So, like, I guess I'm, like, either very stubborn or was very bored, or the truth is, like, I had finally found something that was truly my own. And that was, like, it felt so, like, I know it sounds cliche and it sounds cheesy, but it was so authentic and I was so lost that to have this thing ripped away from me felt so incredibly unfair. And I just fought back after, like, weeping for, like, days. I mean, it was just like somebody had ripped something away from me that was like
it ripped your heart out.
Yeah, like it was inconsolable. And I just thought, like, this isn't right. And one night, like maybe a week or so after that, I just decided to, like, tell everybody about this. And I got on the website for The Economist, which was my favorite magazine. And I wrote this seething email.
I think that's true of all yogurt makers, by the way. They all love The Economist.
Yeah. And I remember writing into, like, it was just their regular comments page. Like, submit your comments to this. And like, thank God they didn't have a word limit because I just let it rip. And I was like, this is what happened to my tiny yogurt company in like Southern California. And we were making eight gallons of yogurt a week. And like, we were up to like 35 gallons of yogurt a week because of like these new markets we were in. And this is what happened. And this is what they're telling us. And The Economist picked up the story.
Wow.
And like, that was incredible. And it's just kind of felt like that since the beginning. It's like that moment at the Huntington Beach Market when someone tasted it for the first time and was like, wow, this is something. Like, I think there's something about what we're doing and what White Mustache is that's so much bigger than me and not in my hands at all. It's like resonating with people because they have their own, like,
yeah, you felt like you'd found the thing. And I know about this feeling because I've had it myself. Like, this is what you were put on this earth to do, and nobody was going to stop you from doing it.
That's right. That's right. And so, you know, besides the Economist article, which was great and got us some opportunities that didn't pan out, but a lot of attention, it inspired me to like stay in California and fight and like use my legal degree. And we went up to Sacramento for 2 years to try to fight this and to like submitted lab reports from generous scientists who donated their time to like put together like data that like, this is why this woman who's buying yogurt or buying milk from a grocery store is not in any way harming public health by like wow. reboiling her milk and turning it into yogurt. And like, I was like, I'll commit to only staying in farmers markets and I'll commit to only making this amount. I'll commit to like whatever you want to commit to. But what I won't do is invest $500,000 in equipment that you need in order to be like, make sure that human hands don't touch
right.
the milk through from the moment that the milk is boiled to the moment the yogurt is capped in its container. They didn't want it to touch human hands. And to me, this is how we lose the art of yogurt making. This is how we lose the art of food production.
Right.
This is why we do need that Vietnamese family and that Mexican family making their cheeses and their milkshakes and paying attention to how that's done if there's a real public health concern to it. But maybe removing some of the barrier to entries that surround that.
And how did you end up convincing him?
I didn't.
You didn't?
I didn't.
So you lost after the 2 years. That's a lot of bus trips to Sacramento, a lot of gas.
Mm-hmm. And we had pro bono counsel. Like, I mean, talk about taking like a sledgehammer to a fly. Like, I was like there with like a bazooka. Be like, I got this. And I didn't have it. I lost.
Wow.
And
wow.
I realized that like I was going to die before the bureaucracy like let me like change things. Because imagine if there was a whole bunch of little yogurt makers in California that had to be regulated.
Right.
It's like, it's a regulatory nightmare. And so, you know, the Economist article got the attention of then Secretary of State Brown, who's now the governor
right.
of Oregon, Kate Brown. And she invited us up there. She's like, we want to make Portland a food city. Like, you should come and make it up here. But even their regulators couldn't wrap their mind around, like, why do you want to boil your milk yourself? Like, you can use machines to do it. Here's, like, a university you can do it in. And I was like, this isn't how, like, there. And then they were like, but financially, this is not viable. And I was like, probably not. But, like, give me the opportunity to fail on my own terms.
Yeah.
You know?
You're going, this is not my sour cherry jam.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then we, by miracle after miracle, ended up in Brooklyn, where the rules are exactly the same as they are in California. But they were willing to be like, okay, show us your process. And how can we get you in line with what you need to
Got
do?
Got it. So, and, wow, that's yeah. that's insane.
It's totally insane.
Homa Mashtaki, our time is up for this episode, but we still haven't even gotten to how I got to taste the yogurt that has changed my life, my digestive tract, my marriage forever. So I'm going to say goodbye for now, Serious Eaters, and then Homa is going to fill us in on her life in New York City. So long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time. And thank you, Homa, for beginning to share your story with us.